Emerald Swindle with another Voice of Freedom program, this time from California. We are with British historian David Irving. Mr. Irving, you handed me your latest action report, a 12-page blockbuster. It's like a mini book in itself with the amount of information in here. And it's just amazing. There's this high court, freeze, jailed, right-wing author, global bid to silence Mrs. Historian Irving, in court bid to end ban, and so on. You seem to be still in hot water around the world. Give us an explanation of how it happened, when it happened, why it is happening to you.
Well, as you know, when you get into a historical controversy, there's two paths that your opponents can take. One is to say, that's an interesting point you made, Mr. Irving. I think it'll be a good idea if we sit around a table and I produce to you the documents which prove that you're wrong, and then you can tell me why you think those documents need to be viewed in a different light, and so on. In other words, a historical debate. Or there's the alternative approach, which involves the use of sulfuric acid, boots, handcuffs, prisons, libel, litigation, smears, defamation,
deportation,
what you can generally call the West Bank tactics, deportation, imprisonment. And I think that the person who's totally neutral and objective about it can weigh these one method against the other and say, well, hey, the one who's using the bully boy tactics is probably frightened of the truth. And he knows that he can't substantiate what he's been saying all these years from the archives, so he uses the alternative approach. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me, and that's my attitude. And when people went around the world calling me a neo-Nazi or a fascist or a liar or a document forger or whatever, I don't care.
But in effect, they have hurt you because
they are hurting me and they're hurting my family.
Right.
They're hurting me and they're hurting my family. They're trying to bankrupt me. They're trying to ruin me. And they're doing it very cleverly, and they're doing it in several different ways. They have taken several months, if not years, to prepare this offensive against me. And only now, in the autumn of 1994, are their various tactics beginning to bear fruit. Around the world, my major publishers are suddenly having second thoughts about publishing my books.
And these are not Holocaust-related books?
Oh, good Lord, no. I've never written a Holocaust-related book. My books are mainline works of history which are published by mainline publishers.
Now let me ask you, before we go on to the persecution that you have suffered now, you are an author of some 34 or 35 books.
Yes.
In the past, for instance, when the first very famous book came out about the destruction of Dresden, there was a historical debate. There was a debate after, the way you said, around the
That's
table,
right.
People looked at the evidence and so on. When effectively did that kind of dealing with your papers, I mean, Hitler and his generals and so on, was also a debate. When did it become so nasty, and why?
The debate turned ugly when I published my book about Adolf Hitler. The biography of Adolf Hitler was published in this country, the United States, by the Viking Press. Now, the Viking Press isn't a hole-and-corner fringe operation. They're not an off-Broadway publisher. The Viking Press is one of the world's great publishing houses. In Britain, the book was published first of all by Hodder and Stoughton, then by the Macmillan Company, and so on. It's published, in other words, by the great publishing houses around the world. The Adolf Hitler biography touched off a very heated controversy among the historians in Germany, a controversy that subsequently became known as the Historiker Streit, the argument about whether Hitler had given an order or whether what happened to the Jews, whatever it was, happened of its own accord. And it's a very interesting debate. And the historians, some have said this, some have said that. They formed into two camps, the constructionalists and the intentionalists and all these other ists. I think somebody once said the only trouble with the most isms is the ists. Uh-huh. And that's the case with these historians in Germany.
But did you get in trouble because you wrote that book from the desk of Adolf Hitler looking into the world? Is that not what you did?
No, I got into trouble because I rubbed the historians nose in the fact that none of them had done the work. None of them had bothered to go into the archives to find out what actually happened. They just copied each other's books. Jekyll bought a book by Jacobson. Jacobson bought the book by Jekyll. Broussard bought the book by Jacobson. Hillgruber bought the book by Broussard, and so on. Went on. They were just buying each other's books and copying each other's mistakes and prejudices. And this bubble was just getting bigger and bigger, and eventually it had to be burst. And I didn't even set about bursting that bubble. It's just that I went into the archives, and for 10 years, from 1965 until 1975, I researched in the world's archives and found out what actually happened. And that made these historians look pretty stupid, because I said to them, for example, quite simply, okay, Since 1945, you've been saying Adolf Hitler ordered the extermination of the Jews. Where is that order? Where is the slightest shred of evidence of such an order? When did this mystical order take place? When was it issued? 1940? Why didn't they start killing the Jews in 1940? Then 1941? Well, what is the significance of the Wannsee Conference? 1942? There are logical problems with accepting that Adolf Hitler gave an order. And in fact, I found all the documents through all the archives showing that every time Hitler did give an order in connection with the Jews, it was to protect them from something nasty happening to them, which was totally, for example, in the spring of 1942, there's one document where Adolf Hitler is quoted by a top minister as saying that he wants the solution of the Jewish problem postponed until after the war's over. So how can you square that with the so-called Hitler orders that all these idiot historians have been talking about?
Now, is it then that there is like a confluence of interest groups that want you silenced or want you humbled? Not only the historians whom you have shown up as being almost like copycats as you once described it, a dog
it's
chasing its own tail.
It's not just humiliating. I can stand any amount of humiliation because I've never set out to be a very arrogant or proud person in the first place. I'm a very humble kind of historian. I don't care that I'm just plain mister. I don't set great store by being professor or doctor or professor, doctor, doctor or whatever the Germans. I mean, in Germany, every second chimney sweep has to have a doctor's title in front of his name. Now, and I'm very humble in that respect. What I do care about is being smeared. Mm-hmm. And they smear me from one end of the globe now to the other. Deborah Lipstadt, for example, she went all over Australia, paid for by the Jewish community in Australia, the same people who paid to have me kept out of Australia. Mm-hmm. They paid to fly Deborah Lipstadt from Atlanta, Georgia, down to Australia. They flew her around the entire country for a month, lecturing here and there on campuses all over the country to try and repair the damage that had been done by the controversy about whether I should be let in or not. And her main claim about me was she said, this guy Irving, do you know that in his office in London he sits beneath a portrait of Adolf Hitler? This is totally untrue. But this is the kind of level of their debate. They smear and they ridicule because they know that they can't justify themselves
but
on the
did she not also demand from TV stations and TV hosts in writing that if she appeared on their program that they would not allow somebody like a revisionist to rebut her?
Yes, there was a program by ABC Television, Australian Broadcasting Corporation. They interviewed her at great length one evening. I've got the videotape of it. My agent sent me a videotape of it. And there she is. I never realized how unattractive she is to look at. I mean, this is unimportant. She probably thinks I'm unattractive. But believe me, she's homely. That's the word I think they use. And there she is, the Australian interviewer, very urbane and suave Australian television compere, says, Ms. Lipstadt, before we get on to the actual interview, can I just ask you to explain why it is that you refused to come on this program this evening unless we would confirm in writing to you that you were not going to be on the same program with any revisionists? And she said, that is correct.
She admitted that she made that as a precondition of appearing.
That was a precondition of her appearing. They are frightened of appearing on the same program with anyone who is in a position to challenge their hypotheses and their notions and their fairy stories.
So it's not really education.
For example, I'd say to her,
it's indoctrination.
I'd say to her, Ms. Lipstadt, you believe that 1 million people were gassed in Auschwitz. 2 years ago you would have said 4 million, but okay, you brought the figure down to 1 million. You believe that 1 million people were gassed in Auschwitz, that 1 million people were cremated in Auschwitz. Do you know how much coke it takes to cremate a million bodies? Can you show me on these photographs where these mountains of coke were, these tens of thousands of tons of... This is the kind of... I know it's tasteless. They prefer to argue on the emotional, the sentimental level.
Now, the cremation issue that you just raised is interesting because Topf and Sons has just recently been in the news in North America and around the world, in fact.
In today's newspapers here in Los Angeles, there's an article in the Los Angeles Times that the Topf family is quite rightly trying to get back all the property that was stolen from them by the communists after the war on the pretext of the fact that they designed crematorium ovens, which happened to be used in the concentration camps.
Now, they were reported in the Canadian press as having designed these highly efficient or the most efficient crematories that produced 35 or 36 cremations a day.
That's what it says in today's Los Angeles Times. The Topf family was proud and they produced a documentation showing that their most efficient crematorium oven was capable of handling sometimes as many as 25 to 36 corpses per day.
So this would be similar to what Leuchter said And if you calculate the figures, then that would pretty well tell us how few bodies could have been cremated in Auschwitz.
The problem is that most of the exterminationist historians, the Holocaust deniers, mm-hmm. They can't count. They can't count. It's more than five. And when it's more than five, it becomes a lot. One, two, three, four, five, a lot. And when you that kind of concept of mathematics, they're incapable of dividing 36 into a figure like 6 million, and working out how many crematorium years it would take to dispose of all these bodies.
You know that Fred Leuchter, of course, the man that we sent to Auschwitz to investigate these camps there,
very brave
is
man.
In trouble exactly because he apparently made fun of the dead, which is against the law. He kind of ridiculed the dead, insulted the dead, because he calculated out and he said they would still be cremating bodies in Auschwitz based on the figures that they are giving us, and calculating it according to Topf & Son's specifications. Now, you yourself used to say at one time that there was a Holocaust,
I don't use that word.
The Jewish community is up in arms because you changed your mind, in fact,
your interpretation. Everybody has a right to change his mind, to revise his opinion. And when you come up against new and fresh, look at the way that the Auschwitz Museum has revised its figures. They, too, have changed their mind.
Right.
And they're going to have to change their mind again. They're going to have to bring down even further. This is quite plain. Foolishly, they're doing it stage by stage and hoping that we're not going to notice.
So are you saying then to us that it is the Jewish community leaders, not the historical community, that is giving you most grief? Like with these deportation hearings and in Australia having you barred and so on. That's not academics in Australia trying to have you barred.
I think that the ordinary Jew in the street, if you can think of such a concept, doesn't care a hoot about this. But there are self-appointed Jewish community leaders, like Bronfman in the United States, or like Ignaz Bubitz, the criminal leader of the Jewish community in Germany. These self-appointed leaders of these Jewish communities, they have powerful vested interests to protect in the interests of their community. And they can only do this by either debating with us, or by putting as much pressure as they possibly can on governments around the world. And I know this is going on because one benefit of these very costly legal actions that I'm fighting in Canada and in Australia and in Germany has been that these governments have been ordered by the courts to open their files to me. And lo and behold, in the files of the Australian government and of the Canadian government, we find the letters written by the Board of Deputies of British Jews, or by Ignaz Bubitz, the criminal head of the Jewish community in Germany, or by the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, or by the Australian Congress of Jews. The letters are there in the files, letters which they had never believed, and their worst dreams would one day fall into my hands. Mm-hmm. And they're the letters. A letter from the Board of Deputies of British Jews to the German government demanding that I should be arrested and imprisoned.
And the reasons why? Do they give a reason why?
Because I've been into Germany, despite a ban on going into Germany. I wasn't even told that I was banned from going into Germany. The German government's files now reveal that they knew that I hadn't been told I was banned. Mm-hmm. They'd kept this secret from me.
I want to ask you on this criminal head of the German Jewish community. Explain yourself to our Anglo-Saxon English-speaking readers in America and around the world. What do you mean by that?
It may sound tasteless to say this, but as the Jewish community in Australia is making great play of the fact that David Irving is a criminal and a convict, by virtue of having been convicted in Germany of expressing an opinion, mm-hmm. An opinion which happens to be true, I think I'm entitled to describe the president of the Council of Jews in Germany, Ignaz Bubitz, as criminal in view of the fact that he was convicted to a 12-year prison sentence for racketeering.
During the old communist regime.
Makes no difference.
Right.
Makes no difference. He was a citizen of the German Democratic Republic. He was convicted of racketeering and sentenced to a 12-year prison term. I'm very curious to see what happens if Ignaz Bubitz tries to go to Australia, or Canada for that matter, to see if they let him in. Because unlike thought crimes, mm-hmm. I'm sure that racketeering and fraud and embezzlement are crimes in Canada just the same as they are in the former German Democratic Republic.
Yeah. No, but of course he now says, these are like comparable to having crimes committed under Stalin. How do you answer to that? Embezzlement is embezzlement, whether under Stalin or under anybody else.
As a Swabian, you will understand the German expression is "gibt Sotte und Sotte."
Yeah.
There are crimes and there are crimes.
Right.
Thought crimes, the kind of crimes you get sent to a gulag or a psychiatric institution for, I can accept. Okay, those are Stalinist crimes, they are political crimes. Mm-hmm. Racketeering, smuggling, black market sales of scarce products like coffee beans in the communist empire, amassing huge fortunes of millions and millions of dollars, as Bubis did, by means of racketeering, earned him justifiably a 12-year prison sentence, which he then managed to escape. So this is a conviction which would stand up in any court around the world.
So you are saying that they are rather selective in their outrage and seizing the moral high ground.
I'm not going to hold my breath and expect that Bubis will have to sweat even one day in jail. I don't think there's any danger of that now.
Yeah. You mentioned also that they have to protect, the Jewish leadership has to protect powerful vested interests. What exactly are these powerful interests?
They have state interests to protect. Obviously we're getting into a very delicate area here, a very sensitive area here.
Are you referring to reparations?
It's quite evident to me that the interests of the state of Israel depend very solidly on the prolonged belief of the world's population in the Holocaust legend, in all its glory, in all its romance. The notion of one madman in the name of the German people having killed 6 million people in a bestial and grotesque manner. That is basically what the Holocaust legend is about. If any damage is done to the Holocaust legend, if it turns out it wasn't 6 million but 1 million or 500,000, or if it turns out that they weren't killed in a brutal and grotesque manner but that they died very largely by means of epidemics or accidents or air raids or whatever, or if it turns out that they weren't the victims of one madman acting in the name of the German people but several hundred ordinary, rather grubby criminals who decided to take revenge on these people who had fallen into their power, then all this does damage to the Holocaust legend and the money-earning power of the Holocaust legend.
So and that's the vested interest.
This is the vested interest. Power. The state of Israel depends very substantially on the $4 billion it earns every year from the Holocaust in terms of subsidies given to it by the German government and by the American taxpayer.
But isn't the Holocaust also frequently used as a weapon or as a shield behind which some people, for instance, I know in Toronto, one man was a Czech ambassador, and he walked up in front of the judge and said, "Please go easy on me, I'm a child of Holocaust survivors."
A child of Holocaust survivors. They do use it frequently. I tried to give a lecture in Argentina two or three years ago. At the very last moment, the German club in Argentina asked me to lecture on a different theme because this couple sitting at the table in the front row, the man, his parents had died in the gas chambers in Auschwitz. It wasn't until several months later that the club wrote me a letter apologising in London saying, "We have now made some discreet inquiries. It turns out he was born in 1947, 2 years after the war ended. A long pregnancy, I have to say. This is the way they use it. And of course, it goes further. And I'm anxious not to go too far down this road because I'm not anti-Semitic. You know, I'm the person who could least be described as anti-Semitic, although the Jews would claim differently. You know, the definition of an anti-Semite now is not somebody who doesn't like the Jews, it's somebody whom the Jews don't like. Uh-huh. He is an anti-Semite. And I suppose under that category they feel quite comfortable with calling me an anti-Semite because they don't like me.
Yeah. Now, I want our listeners to hear all the things you have been through, all the places you have been banned from and so on, because it means that you can illustrate on your own person.
Now, believe me, there is no international Jewish conspiracy. It's purely fortuitous that they have managed to get me banned from Germany, Italy, Austria, France, South Africa, Canada, not the United States yet, Australia, New Zealand, and no doubt a large number of other countries where I haven't tried setting foot yet, all within the space of the last 2 years. I didn't accept that there was a conspiracy or that they had power until the moment on June the 13th, 1992, when I walked down the steps of a German plane at Rome International Airport in Italy and found the plane surrounded by police cars and police officers calling out my name. I was supposed to lecture at the University of Rome that afternoon. I'd been invited by a professor. I never got further than the airport building. I was put straight on another plane back to Munich. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, I realized we are dealing here with a force, with a power, which transcends frontiers and which is capable of picking up a phone and telephoning the Prime Minister of Italy. And it is the Prime Ministers who are involved. I know this now because from the Australian fires, for example, all the documents from the German government to the Australian embassy in Bonn have been marked, they've been sent down to Canberra, the capital of Australia, marked for the personal attention of the Prime Minister, the personal attention of the Australian
government. There is a book out in Australia just recently.
Yes.
What is that called, and where can people obtain the book? It's about your case, right?
It's a book by Nigel Jackson. I think he's I haven't seen the book in any great detail yet. I think he's gone into the history of the various cases that I've been fighting, particularly the case in Australia. But the battle in Australia is still going on, of course. We're fighting them now in the federal court in Australia yet again. We won the first round last year in the federal court. The Australian government was ordered to think again and to give me the visa. The Australian government then changed the law. The Australian government changed the law so that they could say that anybody who is of bad character is not going to be let. So in May this year, the Australian government announced in Parliament, we've decided we're not going to let Mr. Irving in because he's of bad character. And when the Australian newspapers phoned me, I was in the United States touring and lecturing at the time, I said to the Australian newspapers, it's a very unusual experience to be called of bad character by an Australian minister. I now know what it would feel like to have Lieutenant Colombo criticising the style of my raincoat.
Now, this is nothing to joke about because, of course, it has damaged...
You've got to joke about it. You've got to look down on it.
It has damaged you. You are a man with a new young family.
Yeah.
You have just had another child,
yet another daughter.
To a wonderful-looking Danish woman. And now you're starting out. You have to provide for this family. Mm. You earn your living by writing, by speaking, and these people keep banning you from all these countries where you used to be welcomed. I mean, your books... In Canada, we have them in the military colleges.
There are hundreds of thousands of people around the world waiting for the chance to hear me speak. And, of course, it inflicts severe damage on me and on my image and on my reputation, because all the time that I'm away from a country, these people can say what they like about me behind my back. Mm-hmm. I can give you a small cameo example of that. Last week, in England, I had to give evidence in a trial of a thug who had demolished my car. He'd demolished my car, along with a mob of other people. They'd kicked the doors and smashed the windows. I'm sitting in it with my driver. They're trying to turn the car over and set fire to it. The police arrive 3 or 4 minutes later and make several arrests. One of these men is put on trial. His defense lawyer asked for me to be taken out of the courtroom while he told the judge what argument he proposed to follow, because the judge had stopped his line of argument. So I was taken out of the courtroom 3/4 hour, went back in, the judge said, Mr. Irving can stand down. It wasn't until the following day that I read in the newspapers what they'd said in my absence, and that's how they get away with it. They say these things in my absence. Our client, the defendant, this thug, he was trying to stop a crime because he had heard someone getting into Mr. Irving's car saying, let's go and demolish a Jewish cemetery. What can you say when they use methods like this? It never in my wildest dreams would it occur to me I'm going to have to go and defend myself in an English witness box against the allegation that I or somebody else, one of my associates, was setting about demolishing a Jew. I would have had to go around the streets of Brighton saying, excuse me, can you tell me where there's a Jewish cemetery? I don't know where the Jewish cemeteries are.
In other words, you had just come from a lecture, we're dressed in a business suit.
I was
suit.
In a pinstripe suit.
And you would have...
I would have had to have a sledgehammer in one hand and a can of spray paint in the other. But it's reported in every English newspaper, and no doubt around the world, because that's the way they do it. They report these things instantly, like that. In Germany, as you know, a year ago, I was fined 30,000 Deutschmarks, or $22,000, for expressing an opinion, a one-line opinion which happens to be true, namely the fact that the gas chamber they show the tourists in Auschwitz is a fabrication, a post-war fabrication. The Auschwitz authorities have now admitted that I'm right, yet I've been fined and no one's paying me the money back. On the basis of that fine, I have a criminal conviction. And because of the criminal conviction, Australia can say, we're not going to let Mr. Irving in.
And the Canadians use
it. And the Canadians and the New Zealanders, the South Africans and all the rest. And the whole thing is built up on this inverted pyramid of a so-called lie, a so-called conviction, which turns out to be the truth. And on top of that, as you rightly say, there's the legal cost. In Australia, I've had to spend $50,000 already. In Canada, I've had to spend $40,000 in defending myself and in standing up for freedom of speech and the truth, as it turns out. But if they think that they can silence me, they're very wrong. See, they underestimate the English. Because every country that I'm banned from, Australia, South Africa, wherever it is, every time the Jewish community in the world succeeds in getting me banned from another country, it's another victory for me.
How do you make that? I mean...
I can do without Italy. Mm-hmm. I can even do without Germany. But every time they are admitting that in the whole of Germany, in the whole of Italy, they've not got one historian who's capable of standing up to me. So the only solution is shut him up, ban him, gag him, put him in prison, preferably in handcuffs, and throw away, for God's sake, his fountain pen.
Many of the witnesses that testified in my trial have basically come out with the short end of the stick.
Yeah.
In your case, it is the most extreme because you are the most feared. You had become, shortly after that trial, really like the locomotive of revisionism. Mm-hmm. And they feared you because you made this kind of audacious claim that the Holocaust would be kind of exploded or explained away within a very short period of time.
2 years, I said, yeah. And I think we've passed that point, because 2 years ago, when I made that claim, the number of people around the world who challenged the Holocaust or who didn't believe in it was probably fewer than 1%. Mm-hmm. Infinitesimally small, insignificantly small number of people. The figures which are now quoted by the newspapers, in the United States last year it was 25%, but the Jewish community managed by the usual kind of chicanery to get that figure reduced by dismissing the head of the institute who came up with his
creating a new poll,
asking the correct question, showing people photographs first and all the rest of it. In Australia they came up with the same kind of figures, 10%.
But now there's an American poll out of the Midwest again recently.
25%. 25% don't believe the Holocaust happened. And this is a result. You have to bear this in mind. 25% of people in a town in the Midwest don't believe the Holocaust happened, despite everything that the media tells them.
The massive
multi-billion-dollar efforts of the media, the Schindler's lists, and all the rest of it. These ordinary people are using their own grey stuff and saying, hey, the revisionists have got a case.
Now, the situation then is that you are unbowed, you are intellectually and physically fit, you are working, you are
bloodied
writing.
Bloodied but unbowed, mm-hmm. Dismasted but not dismayed. You see, you're dealing with a poet here.
Yeah, but you are not throwing in the towel then.
Not until they have to throw me in with it.
You're a man of infinite courage, David Irving. I admire you.
I think people like Fred Leuchter have more courage than me, because I've been through this before, and I've been through the fires of hell. Somebody like Fred Leuchter, he didn't know what he was biting off. He didn't know what he was in for. And yet he withstood this particular firestorm of outrage with great masculinity and with a degree of courage which I find is inspiring.
I want to thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you very much.